morning, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, as you all know, and it's my pleasure. You know that because I'm wearing a name tag, right? There it is. It's my pleasure to welcome you here on behalf of University College of Syracuse University. I have some important announcements to make. Well, I have some announcements to make today and a preview of some upcoming programs. First of all, I wanted to share with those of you who hadn't realized that today's date is 10-11-12, which has absolutely no significance whatsoever. But there you have it. So don't get all worried about it. Nothing bad's going to happen. All right. Next week's program is we're going to be talking about changes at the Post Standard with Stephen A. Rogers, editor and publisher currently of the Post Standard, and Tim Kennedy, who is president of the Syracuse Media Group, and thanks to Stan Lindhorst for helping to arrange that. The following week, we'll be talking with Dr. Kamal Jabor on cybersecurity, and an old friend, Shukai Chin, will be introducing him, so that's October 25th. When we get into November, I'll just give you a heads up. November 1st, it looks like we will be having New York State Comptroller DiNapoli here with us. And then on November 8th, the week after the election, we'll have our friends from the Ivory Tower come to talk to us. So that'll be great. So that's the next couple of weeks. I also wanted to remind you that the Onondaga Citizens League, which is studying refugee resettlement this year, has a film series. On October 16th, that's this coming Tuesday at 7 o'clock, we'll be showing our second film, which is Rain in a Dry Land. Kind of follows two Somali Bantu families from the camp in Kenya, where they had been for a number of years, and two different families who come, one to Massachusetts, another to Georgia. And it's very enlightening, and we follow it with a discussion. Heidi Holtz is the co-chair of the study, and she'll be moderating a discussion. So if you want more details, I have posters and postcards, and the information is also on OnondagaCitizensLeague.org. So I highly recommend that. This morning, it is my pleasure to introduce Syracuse City School District Superintendent Sharon Contreras. I'll give you a heads up, those of you who are here maybe and don't get to ask your question today, or those of you who are listening on WCNY-FM on Sunday night, that the superintendent will be joining the Institute. Well, she won't be joining the Institute for Retired People, but she'll be speaking to, not yet anyway, not till she's done with her five-year plan. All right, she'll be speaking to the Institute for Retired People next Thursday, October 18th, and that's a noon program of University College. So, of course, I always highly recommend that program as well. But anyway, right now, I've totally left my notes at the table, but it's been a year, almost exactly a year, since the superintendent was here. I think she was just barely into 100 days in Syracuse, and she told us then about what some of her ideas and some of her plans, and I think today we're going to hear more about how that has turned into great expectations. What I remember from listening to the superintendent was I was so impressed with her focus. I mean, you know, there were this issue and that issue and all of these issues that are impacting the children in our schools. But, you know, her focus, she'll tell us more about today. But, again, she graduated from Binghamton University and also the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she's a PhD candidate. She started out as an English teacher, so make sure you formulate your questions correctly and in the form of a question. And then she worked her way up through the ranks in various school districts. Last before she came here in Providence, Rhode Island. And again, it's been about a year. Thank you for coming back. And please welcome Sharon Contreras.
Good morning. Yes, I am a proud English teacher, and I drive my staff crazy correcting their emails, letters, memos. I said, that's something that doesn't die easily. I believe in great writing. It is my pleasure to be here today. The last time I spoke to you, I was learning about the system and the many nuances of the system. I was in the midst of my first 100 days, and I was telling you in general about the context of public education nationally and in Syracuse. But this morning, I can say that I have learned a great deal at this point, and the Syracuse City School District actually has a five-year plan or strategic plan for improvement, and it's my pleasure to talk to you about that this morning. We have, as a board and superintendent and as the school district, created our new mission, vision, and ultimate goal for the district. And you will see the mission simply defines why we are here, and that is to make sure we prepare students for active citizenship and that we prepare them for college, technical schools, careers, and for success in a new economy. Our vision, what we aim to do, is simply to become the most improved urban school district in America. In 5 years, we will not be the highest performing school district in the United States, but we can become the most improved. We have the resources and the talent. And the ultimate goal, what we will build in the next 5 years, is an educational community dedicated to what I just mentioned, which is preparing students for active citizenship, making sure they're prepared for college, careers, and the global economy. I want to start this morning by talking about a meeting I recently attended for the New York State School Superintendents and Commissioner John King, who leads the State Education Department, reminded us or presented to some of us about an article, an op-ed piece from Tom Friedman in the New York Times that was written several weeks ago, and it is entitled New Roles. Simply, he makes the case that Bill Clinton's argument more than 20 years ago about working hard and playing by the rules will no longer help students realize the American dream. There was a point, and you remember when he ran for office, he kept saying, if you work hard and play by the rules, you should have access to the American dream and be able to make a livable wage to take care of your families. But that is no longer true. And Tom Friedman makes the case that President Barack Obama should not try to make the same case that Bill Clinton does because the rules have changed. In fact, technology and globalization have dramatically changed the world, and today there are new demands of education as a result of the economic changes and national needs. So the new rules, or the key to getting into and remaining in the middle class, require that you have to work even harder, that you must frequently reinvent yourself and obtain at least some form of post-secondary education. You must make sure that you're engaged in lifelong learning, and you must play by the rules. Tom Friedman gives the example of the country of Estonia, where students at the age of 6 and 7 years old, first graders, are being trained or taught computer programming because Estonia created Skype back in 2002, 2003, and they continue to want to be competitive in a global economy. So they are changing the way they educate students. Let's look at this data. Higher education has never mattered more. There's a direct correlation between employment rates and the degree that you have, or the level of education you have. So if you cannot see that, in 2002, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the unemployment rate for those with a professional degree, it was 1.9%. But look at those without a high school diploma. Their unemployment rate was 14.9%, which is why we embrace the Say Yes theory of action and mission to provide all students for college and careers. And it is not that we expect every single student will want to attend college, but they will be prepared for college, and they will be able to make the choice about whether they wish to attend college or not. What are we preparing them for? Let's look at this data. 7 of the top 10 fastest growing occupations require a post-secondary degree. You see number 1 and 2, biomedical engineers, network systems analysis, require bachelor's degrees. There are only 3 of the top 10 that do not require at least a bachelor's degree for success. There's a need for highly skilled workers. There are 3 million jobs that have gone unfilled because of a mismatch between the skills needed and the skills that are actually supplied. College and career readiness, therefore, is no longer aspirational, but it is a moral, economic, and political imperative. Bill Clinton said at the Democratic National Convention, "We have to prepare more Americans for the new jobs that are being created in a world fueled by new technology. That's why investments in our people, in more community colleges, Pell Grants, and career and technical classes are more important than ever." And I will talk a little bit later about the work we're doing in the Syracuse City Schools to prepare students for careers. There is a new normal, and that's what Secretary Arne Duncan, spoke about in one of his latest speeches. Countries can justify the world's highest wages only by offering the world's most original ideas and the highest skill levels. These new high skills and innovative capacities cannot be reserved for the few. We must radically rethink how we prepare students and rethink educational systems, because right now the educational system allows only some to access intellectually rigorous curriculum. We have to recruit more teachers with more education, and we must demand higher standards for entrance into teacher preparation programs. In the highest performing countries, the teachers come from the top 10% of their graduating classes. That is not true in the United States. We also have to discontinue practices that direct funding to those easiest to educate while denying funding and additional resources to the students most in need. I often read the work of Marguerite Rosa, who studies school funding, and she gives examples of how we give students who don't need as much, we spend more on them per pupil. An example of this would be advanced classes versus remedial classes. Advanced placement classes generally have lower numbers of students. So if you have an advanced placement class of 15 and a remedial class or intervention class of 30, just think for that one class, the average teacher salary for that one section is $15,000. You are spending per pupil about $500 per year on the students who need the intervention, while spending about $1,000 per year on the student who is advanced. We have to look at how we fund students and make sure that we employ a weighted student funding system. There are new standards for learning, and if done correctly, the internationally benchmarked Common Core is a key lever of equalizing decades of differentiated expectations and performance gaps. The demands of rigor in the Common Core are thus far unparalleled. There are no standards that have been created in the past that have the rigor of the Common Core. The intellectual shifts within the Common Core demand new ways of thinking and problem solving, and at least 46 other states have signed on to the Common Core. The exceptions are states like Texas. The importance of the curriculum aligned to the Common Core cannot be overstated. We are engaged in deep work in the Syracuse City School District to develop a curriculum that is aligned to these new internationally benchmarked standards. But look at the research from the U.S. Department of Education. Academic curriculum participation is still the strongest of the pre-collegiate momentum indicators. And high school curriculum reflects 41% of the resources that students bring to higher education, with test scores accounting for about 30%, and the actual class rank academic GPA being 29%. It is imperative that all students have access to an intellectually rigorous curriculum. So what will you see in these new classrooms? And I am so proud to say, when I walk into the classrooms this year, and we are just in the initial stages of the rollout, I'm starting to see this. You'll see students reading more nonfiction in earlier grades, rich reading of science and social studies. Many of you know, in our elementary schools, and this isn't just true of Syracuse, it's true in many places, that many elementary teachers no longer teach science and social studies. They've been so focused on English and math. Students will be talking to each other and not just the teacher. You'll see writing will be more prevalent across the classrooms and content areas. And this is so critical. I just looked at a study on a high school that has been transformed. And you probably know that high schools are the most difficult schools to transform if they are underperforming. What the school did was focus almost entirely on improving student writing and writing in every content area. In history classrooms, you will not just rely on personal perspective, but engage with words that authors choose. You'll see that teachers will ask students to respond with evidence from the text. Instead of just giving an opinion about it, they have to present evidence and make their case. In science class, students will be asked to write with evidence rather than just describing their details. And you will connect writing with evidence in science to the writing with evidence in English language arts classrooms. In math, students will not learn a set of rules or memorize facts, but are engaged with tools to solve complex problems. Math is a place now to get answers with mathematical reasoning. And in science classes, students will be asked to utilize mathematical practices. If you walk into our schools, you will see the beginnings of this effort. You will also eventually see, I believe, resource savings from implementation of the Common Core, which I just think is a key lever in transforming public schools in the United States. If we do this right, students in need of remediation or developmental classes in higher education will no longer spend money on classes that do not count for credit. That money could go towards other worthwhile initiatives in higher education. And in the P-12 system, pre-K-12 system, money can go towards enrichment, acceleration, and the arts instead of double reading classes, double math classes, and constantly trying to catch students up who come to school behind and during the course of their education continue to fall further and further behind. What we're seeing with the rollout of the Common Core and what it will do if we implement this right is roll back on curriculum narrowing. And so many of you have heard about that, that with the onset of testing, that we have narrowed the curriculum. But we will no longer solely focus on ELA and math as tested subjects, but make sure there is full content integration. Will make students more competitive in the 21st century through the focus on application of skills, and will help more students succeed in advanced placement classes, in international baccalaureate programs, and enter college better prepared for rigor. I met with a parent earlier this week who shared with me that three of her daughters had completed the international baccalaureate program at Corcoran High School, and she had two more girls enrolled in the program right now. She has a total of six daughters. And she shared with me that her daughters are so successful in college, and they feel they are better prepared than their peers because of the focus in the International Baccalaureate program and the focus on writing. Just focus on a more rigorous curriculum and focus on writing. Today she has a daughter working in the Harlem Children's Zone, and she has daughters at both Hunter College and Syracuse University doing very well. And of course, the implementation of the Common Core, if done correctly, will close the persistent achievement and opportunity gaps that currently exist in our country and in the Syracuse City School District. The annual Professional Performance Review, or APPR, is the second key lever that I believe will transform American public education. For the first time, teacher and leader evaluations link student performance to the evaluation itself. As you know, there is a need for effective teachers, more in urban schools than anywhere else, because the most precious resource that we can offer our students are teachers, and our children need the very best teachers. APPR can help our teachers improve professional practice. The data allows us to capture nuanced information about teacher and principal performance. We adjust and provide support for improvement and continually assess progress all year long. Where evaluation was once an event, it is now a process. Now, when you look at the implementation of the Common Core and the teacher leader evaluation system together, and you think about good implementation, we believe that good implementation will lead to differentiated professional development. One of the things you often hear teachers talk about is we offer a professional development course for everybody, irrespective of where you might be professionally. We offer the same professional development. This allows us to hone in on what teachers need. It helps teachers and principals plan for specific student outcomes. So where we just taught in the past and we hoped we were doing a good job and we would meet the needs of the majority of students, many students' needs would go unaddressed because we did not focus on specific outcomes for each student. We are now making principals capable instructional leaders instead of building managers who focus on keeping the lights on and the discipline, who can handle and identify and promote instruction aligned to the Common Core. When you walk into our schools, you will see our teachers engaged in team planning, and it is remarkable to see where you will hear them using shared language about good instruction and practice, and there is transparency and sharing of excellent practices. When I started teaching 20 years ago, nobody came into my classroom. The English teachers would have coffee together, but we did not sit and discuss great practice. And we will ensure a future with more students ready for college and careers. I want to talk about the APPR system. It's a 60-40 system where 60% of the evaluation is based on professional practice and 40% is based on student growth. You will see that student readiness for post-secondary education and the workforce is why we teach. We all know that's why we teach. But our new teaching and learning rubric provides a vision of excellence for how we teach. This is related to the Common Core state standards, which provide a vision of excellence for what we teach. And we have been working to communicate this to teachers so that they don't feel that so much is coming down on them that is unrelated. Here's the teacher evaluation system, the Common Core, all of these other initiatives. These initiatives are related and have the power, if done correctly, to transform education. When you look at the 40%, which is the student growth or student performance piece, we are developing for every teacher student learning objectives, which prompt two key questions. What is it this course intends to achieve, and how will we know when we have achieved it? Educators now have a responsibility to set academic targets through these student learning objectives, or what we call SLOs. There's support for using data-driven instruction. So they assess, they teach, they assess to see if students have reached mastery or have understanding, and then teachers adjust their teaching. The SLOs provide guidance in designing and implementing quality instruction, not for the majority of students or for some students, but for every single student. And this data will ensure alignment of resources, priorities, and teacher supports. We received our first round of growth scores back from the state. And it's interesting to see there are schools where the teachers have high growth scores in reading, but lower growth scores in math. We were able then to provide that school with more math support, instructional coaches in math. And the same is true where we experienced schools where teachers had higher growth scores in math, lower growth scores in reading. We now have rich information and data, although imperfect. It is still imperfect, but we have data that helps us support teachers in becoming more effective. And of course, this means that there is a new normal for teachers. We expect the majority of teachers to perform at higher levels of rigor and innovation on a national scale. This requires that we have the very best teachers, that we have competitive compensation, we improve the quality of professional training, both pre-service and in-service, and that we improve working conditions and once again hold teachers in high esteem for the role they play in American society, in our state, and in our city. This requires help at many different levels, not just in the school system, to systemically change teaching. That requires the entrance requirements for teacher colleges being more rigorous, changing the way that teachers are inducted into the workforce. We currently have a partnership with SUNY Oswego to provide to us more teacher candidates in the field of English language learning. Those teacher candidates will spend an entire year shadowing a teacher and participating, student teaching in the classroom, as opposed to the 6 to 8 weeks that many of us experienced when we did our student teaching. We must change how teachers are compensated, incentivizing and rewarding. Incentivizing teachers for going into some of our schools that are struggling and rewarding students who are showing outstanding student growth. We have to change the structure of the profession and create career ladders. Many of you have read about our Teacher Incentive Fund grant, where we've established a career ladder for master teachers, because there are many teachers who do not want to go into administration, never want to become administrators, but currently in the field, there's no way to advance within teaching. So we now have career ladders for teachers. We must reconsider the level of teacher authority and make sure that teachers have more of a say in their own practice and what happens in their schools, and of course, align the pedagogy to the new rigorous standards. And we have some successes, and I am so proud to talk about the work that SCSD is doing. We have submitted one of the top 10 model APPR plans for the state. So not only was our APPR plan one of the first approved in the state, but it is used as a model by New York State. And I have to thank Kevin Ahern of STA and the membership for their work in developing that APPR plan. It speaks to the collaboration that is occurring in our district to improve student achievement. I do not have a contentious relationship with any of our unions because they are deeply concerned about student performance and they work with me to improve the schools. We've created an instructional practice and school building leadership rubric aligned to the Common Core standards. That is groundbreaking, not just in this state, but in this nation. It is one of the first rubrics in the nation to be aligned to the Common Core. It is the first district-created, state-approved rubric in New York State. That rubric is being utilized in all of our K-5 classrooms this year, and we intend to expand that to our 6th through 12th grade classrooms next year. There is training, a certification process, and an ongoing calibration process for our school leaders to make sure there is little to no subjectivity in implementation of the rubric and the APPR system. The principals went through training all last year, and they have another year-long training this year. We expect in 3 years that there will be little difference from evaluator to evaluator. We also have engaged with the American Institutes of Research to come in and do an independent program evaluation of the implementation of APPR, because we want our teachers and our building leaders to have confidence that these evaluation systems are fair and, more importantly, that they help them improve professional practice. And last night we received news that we were awarded a $2.5 million Strengthening Teacher and Leader Effectiveness Grant as a result of this work. So, how does all of this work fit in? All of these are critical pieces, but they had to be memorialized somewhere. And we have now the strategic plan, which prioritizes that work. And you have copies on your table of Great Expectations, which was approved by the board in August. Our 5-year strategic plan is a visionary document that provides guidance for how we will engage in the work for the next 5 years. It empowers us to prioritize needs and allocate resources accordingly. So if it's not in the plan, we're not going to do it unless we revise the plan based on new information we have that there is a critical need. And this plan is a mechanism to hold ourselves accountable for very specific, measurable goals. There are 5 goals, the first being to make sure all students have equitable access to rigorous curriculum and aligned instructional materials. The second is about the recruitment, development, support, and retention of effective teachers and leaders. The third goal is about the development and infrastructure to support student success, all of the support necessary so that students have access to the curriculum and are successful with the new curriculum. Goal 4 is about building a culture based on high expectations. This came from the community, the last 2 goals, and making sure there's a culture of co-accountability. And finally, goal 5, which is to communicate effectively with all district stakeholders. That's both our internal stakeholders and the community at large. The guiding principle in our plan is the instructional core. Student learning can only happen in this instructional core. There is a deep relationship between the student, the content, and the teacher, and we must impact the core, the instructional core that you see there, to improve outcomes. You can't see this clearly, but I'll get this out to you. The instructional core resides within a context. The ring outside of it is our strategy, the strategies in the strategic plan. And those strategies relate to culture, structure, the systems, the resources that we have, and our stakeholders. But all of that exists within an environment of collective bargaining agreement, of state laws, and of course, politics. What we are trying to help the community understand is that all stakeholders in our community can either strengthen or detract from the important work that happens in the instructional core. So when I go out and present about the strategic plan, I am trying to help organizations that are deeply committed to partnering with us to make sure that the work they wish to do in the district is aligned to improving the instructional core or supporting that new infrastructure of support. There are targeted outcomes in this plan. Our goal at all levels and all measures is to surpass performance percentages of students in the other Big 5 districts of New York State. And there's been a lot of criticism about this, that why don't you have higher aspirations? What if you turn to pages 10 and 11 in the plan at your leisure, what you'll find that the achievement gap between Syracuse City School District and the other four districts that make up the Big Five, those gaps are enormous. In some places, they are up to 40 percentage points. A plan and the goals within the plan must be attainable, and we could not create targets that would only frustrate our staff and community. So we establish targets that we think we can meet within 5 years, and that you'll see that page when you have time. There's also a pathway to success, which establishes the milestones on the path to academic success or to college career readiness. And they surround third grade readiness, fifth grade readiness, eighth grade readiness, preparation for high school, preparation for 11th grade, getting into college, and success in college. What I am asking for support in is doing a community gap analysis where we determine how many organizations and programs exist that help us with each of these particular milestones. Because I can tell you, I have lots of organizations and support for helping with ninth graders, but very little support when it comes to helping fifth graders transition to middle school. So when we do this community gap analysis, we'll be able to better focus all of the community's resources on the areas where we need the most support. I want to talk, as I conclude, about educational equity and why this is so important. All of the work that I've mentioned, the Common Core, APPR, the strategic plan, and ensuring equity. We have much to be proud of, but there are still huge challenges ahead, and I want us all to realize that. Secretary Arne Duncan said last week, if we're serious about closing the achievement gap, we have to get serious about closing the opportunity gap. And as a country, we're not even close. Unless educational systems change, achievement gaps will not only persist, but widen, threatening the social mobility of people of color. The persistence of these gaps solidifies the transition of privilege from generation to generation. So the work we do is incredibly important. Some of the action steps we're taking right now to minimize opportunity gaps across the district, we've increased the level of support at each of those seven milestones. We are considering weighted student funding and allocating resources to students and schools based on need. We now offer a consistent academic program at both the middle school and high school level that did not occur before this year, making sure that students in every single school have access to the same high-quality program. We've created a tiered professional development plan focused on the Common Core academic rigor. We continue to focus on early literacy, and hundreds of teachers participated this summer in our new week-long reading academies. We provide a guaranteed and viable curriculum to the Common Core learning standards, and I've talked extensively about that. One of the most exciting pieces of work that's currently occurring is STEM and CTE programming. We currently have a Blue Ribbon Task Force that's being facilitated by the New York State Career and Technical Education Technical Assistance Center. They are working with us, and that task force is made up of elected officials at both the federal and state level, and also the local level, made up of CEOs of local corporations, made up of staff, our teachers, administrators. And we are working to make sure we expand CTE and STEM programming in our schools. We have a commitment not only to the Regents Diploma, but diplomas that also have CTE certification. We've implemented Project Lead the Way, an exciting technology program and our STEM program in every single middle and high school for the first time. and we have opened the newly remodeled and renovated Institute of Technology High School, which includes an engineering and design program and a human and behavioral science programs. And I invite you to go and visit that new school because it is the new reality of public schooling in America. We have increased advanced placement participation in 1 year by 1,000 enrollments. We are very proud of the work that's occurring. But as I think of this, I must stress again how important it is to engage in this work and to focus on equity for every single student. Nearly 50 years ago, four students from North Carolina A&T University walked into a Woolworth to sit at a lunch counter, to fight for the right to sit at a lunch counter and have lunch. Today, these students can sit at the lunch counter, but far too many of them cannot read the menu. That is unacceptable in this country. When you consider the legacy of fighting for equal education from enslaved Africans working and risking literally life and limb to learn to read post-slavery, risking life and limb, attending Freedmen Bureau schools, attending historically black colleges and universities, walking dozens of miles to get to school. That tradition continued during this Jim Crow period with freedom schools and students working to go to freedom schools after working from early in the morning in the fields, going to school, coming back working at night. And I tell you, in my office, there is one of my favorite photographs hanging. And it is a photograph of a freedom school. And in front of the school, there is a burnt cross because members of the Ku Klux Klan placed the cross on the front lawn and set it afire. However, across the cross, you will see the word freedom. They left the cross sitting there and said, "You will not deter us from an equal education." This fight for equal education is international. On the cover of the New York Times yesterday, I read about a little girl, a 14-year-old by the name of Malaya Yousafzai. This young girl was targeted by the Taliban in Pakistan for her desire to go to school. They shot her in the head, and she is fighting for her life today because she stood up and said, "Girls have the right to go to school." I believe the measure of a nation is not how much we do for our own children to provide them with access to the American dream, but what we do for other people's children. And I invite you today to participate with the Syracuse City School District as we continue on our quest to deliver on the democratic promise of equal educational opportunities for every single student. Thank you so much.
Questions? And I might start with one of my own.
Okay.
You've spent the last year learning about the Syracuse district and, you know, assessing the programs there, and then also looking for models of, you know, from other places, what you've done. This is something that we did in the our OCL study committee the other day, to talk about, and we have had successes, and you mentioned that in the slideshow, but could you point to any in particular, what would be what we call best in class, things that we're already doing that maybe you are building upon rather than...
I think the high school graduation initiative is an excellent example the work we're doing to improve the number of students who are actually completing high school. That started long before I got here. It's tied to Say Yes to Education as well. And we are simply building upon that. And you see the success. That 1,000 students or increase in 1,000 enrollments, it's not 1,000 students, it's enrollment, is not a result of me coming here and doing this in 1 year. This is the work being done over time through the Say Yes model, through the high school graduation initiative. The changes in professional development was in the work. So I just came along and said, I have to find the resources for it, but it has always been something that STA and the teachers and even the administrators in this district have advocated for. I can go on and on. The International Baccalaureate program continues to produce some of the most successful students in the state and in this nation. There are great things occurring in the Syracuse City School District.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is almost a little bit of a variation of her question, Sandra's. The plan you just talked about this morning and what's probably in this book, which we obviously haven't read yet, is very comprehensive and very positive and seems to be complete. And if successful over 5 years, it will really dynamically change the process, educational process. My question goes to, as you were just alluding to, what challenges or hurdles did you have to overcome? Because obviously this was, as was mentioned earlier, adopted by the school board, that other people before you were unable to maybe come up with this type of comprehensive plan and therefore limited their opportunities to get to this particular point in time.
Well, obviously, I deeply believe in the Common Core and revolutionizing teacher-principal evaluation systems. That was much more difficult to do before there was a state law mandating it. So my predecessors believed in that too, but we would have lost state funding if we didn't implement. So it's much easier to negotiate when you have state law behind you. But still, there are huge challenges with funding this. I mean, we have worked and worked, but teachers need far more support than we can give them. Our students need far more support than we can give them. Healthcare costs are increasing at 10% a year. We don't have a solution for that, and as far as I know, no one has a solution for that in the public sector. So there are many critical issues that I believe I have some leverage with that others before me may not have had.
I was fascinated by your Big Five and the challenge and that you wanted to move there. And I always used the gradual improvement rather than postpone perfection. And my question, test results include all of the students that we have in the school system. Some of those students are the same refugee children that Sandra spoke about and people with disabilities. Those people may be making greater progress each year than the rest of the school system, but they are not at the level of the others. Is that still in force, and are we going to get rid of it?
Well, the only way we can get rid of it is if federal law changes. But student growth addresses those needs. So what student growth is, you're not trying to reach an absolute target anymore. Those students don't have to get to proficiency right away. What you have to show is growth with like students. So when we receive those growth scores back for a particular teacher, and I'll use myself for Sharon Contreras, they're comparing the students I have in my classroom to the same students in a different classroom or throughout the state. So you have to make growth in comparison to other special education students, in comparison to other English language learners. It's much fairer than the public would believe, and I believe that the reason the public and teachers don't understand it is because it has not been communicated well from the state level and in the media. But you're not held responsible for absolute proficiency. You must show growth with like students.
I'd like to have your view on training people to enter the skilled trades, such as auto mechanic, carpenter, steam fitter, sheet metal man. These are very fruitful and skillful trades, and we need them. I didn't see any reference to that kind of person in your discussion.
Those trades are embedded in our career technical education program, what I refer to as CTE, and they are very important. The only thing I stress is that we cannot push students into the trades over college or push some students into college over the trades. We must prepare them for either, and it must be based on the student's choice. So you will see at ITC, we have a brand new auto mechanic program. At Fowler, the renovation includes a new electrical program that we're very proud of, new cosmetology programs. So we are expanding those programs in every single high school. What we're trying to emphasize, again, is that all students will be prepared for both college and careers.
Good morning. I haven't had a chance to read your whole strategic plan, but skimming of it says I didn't see child development in the plan. And a couple of weeks ago, there's a big to-do in this community about lack of recess. So I was wondering how child development fits into your strategic plan, which I might have to read later.
Okay. Okay, I'm so glad to talk about this. I did not cut recess. This won't die. We absolutely believe in child development. Goal 3 focuses on the infrastructure of support for students. Clearly, that includes looking at full development of children. As you know, the Say Yes model focuses on making sure that students have social emotional support, have supports with mental and physical health, as well as academics. But please know that was not true, is not true. I have never cut recess and have no intention of cutting recess.
Hi. My understanding is that children who attend full-day pre-K are better prepared throughout their school years, from reading readiness all the way through. And in fact, that there is a multiplier effect that benefits them and benefits society as they go through school and into the workplace. Could you talk about plans for extending or expanding pre-K?
Absolutely. And this is also something on the state commissioner's radar. Universal pre-K must be universal. And we have to provide more pre-K classrooms. The problem we are facing is we also have to implement Common Core and the teacher evaluation system. And you often hear me say, we can do anything we want, we can't do everything. So how do we work together to expand pre-K while also making sure that we do not fall behind with the implementation of the Common Core and with APPR? Because you're absolutely correct. Students who attend pre-K do better in school. So we will be working with organizations like ACTS to try to ensure that we expand the number of pre-K classes in the district each year.
Thank you, Superintendent, very much. I have two questions. The one is very short. You may have not cut recess, but I know many elementary teachers that feel they are under pressure not to give recess because of the testing that is required. And secondly, and more importantly, of late, if you've been following the education conversation, which I'm sure you have, there are many people in the education field that feel that we have done it wrong, that creating charter schools is not the answer, and that what we've done is we've put too much pressure on the school districts to perform all these great strides that used to be formed by parents. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I do believe there's an extraordinary amount of pressure on teachers alone and the building administrators, as though they alone are responsible for underperformance in this country. And that simply is not accurate, and it is not fair. With that said, I do believe, however, the adults in the school system should be accountable for student learning in some form. Now, what remains to be seen is if the new evaluation systems are fair enough, if they resort to the use of student data too much. We'll learn that as we progress. But certainly parents have a role to play. But public education and our democracy cannot depend on parents to be successful. If our democracy and our economy depended on whether or not parents do their job, we're in a lot of trouble, particularly in our urban schools today, but not just in the urban schools. If you talk to suburban teachers and rural teachers, they are beginning to face some of the same problems.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Despite best efforts, some kids either don't get to school or what they come from is so horrific that they cannot learn. Either kids who have difficulties learning and are falling behind or have such horrendous personal problems that it's just too difficult. What's the process for students who just can't fit that mold right now?
That are struggling in school. Right now we're providing support services. We have a new student monitoring system where we can identify students early who are off track. We know if they're having discipline problems, attendance problems, academic problems. So that's new to our school system and will be a powerful way in which we can identify students who need support. We have new initiatives with the county, the Promise Zone, and other support services. We have more social workers in our schools than most urban school districts have in terms of the ratio to social worker to students, and we are addressing those problems. But when the problem becomes so critical that they need an alternative setting, we do not have that. And that is in the strategic plan to develop alternative programs and settings for those students because some of them are do not fit well in the traditional setting because what they are facing, as you said, is so horrific.
I missed a bit of this, but it seemed to me you focused mostly on middle school and high school and your plans and strategic efforts there. But it's, I believe the basics start in kindergarten, first, second, third grade.
Well, I think what I focused on is the outcome we want. To get to the outcome of college and career readiness, you must begin at kindergarten. So the rollout of the Common Core begins in pre-K. We've started this. We're further along with the development of the Common Core and with our teacher evaluation system at the elementary level than we are at the high school level. And even our supports are more robust at the elementary level.
Thank you, Superintendent Contreras. I want to remind everybody or tell everybody that the Great Expectations Strategic Plan is on the City School District website. So if you want to pass that information along to other people. And again, thank you for being with us. We'll see you next year.